what we started last time. So starting last lecture and going for the next few lectures, our main goal is going to be compute observables in quantum field theory. And we focused on these two observables, the k-rates and cross-sections. And last time we saw how to relate these decay rates and cross sections to matrix elements, so either to FSI or IM. And today we're going to do the next step in this calculation, this computation. The observable, so we're going to try to relate these matrix elements or these amplitudes to something slightly simpler, which is a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of field. So that's going to be our main result today. So we're going to, the key result for today is we're going to see that we can compute the matrix element IM or FSI by computing the slightly simpler object, which is a time-ordered product of Heisenberg picture fields. And then next week, we'll see how we can relate this to even simpler objects. This is the LSC reduction formula, what it does. And we'll relate this to either even simpler objects, so we can relate this to time-ordered products of free fields. Which can in turn be related to time-ordered products of two free fields, which is just about the simplest object we can, simplest non-trivial object in scalar field theory. So that's where we're going. So we'll make some progress. We'll relate this amplitude to a time-ordered product of Heisenberg picture fields. That's our main goal today. And so in order to make any progress, we're going to have to make some assumptions about what the field operators and creation and annihilation operators look like in an interacting field theory. So on the quiz yesterday, you gave your expectations for what you thought would be the case for what the field operators and creation and annihilation operators would look like in an interacting field theory. So let's just discuss each of these in turn. So the most popular option, most of you thought that particle number should not be conserved in general in an interacting field theory. That's the case. So particles can decay. For instance, we could start off with a muon, end up with a muon and two neutrinos, with more particles at the end than the beginning. So that's something we observe in nature, and we certainly would like to be able to describe creation and destruction of particles in an interacting field theory. That was one of the motivations we saw in the first lecture, in the first tutorial, for why we consider quantum field theory. Is it naturally incorporates particle number non-conservation. So this is going to be the case. The next statement is that the commutation relations between the creation and annihilation operators is the same in the free theory as at equal times as in the interacting theory. And we're basically that's going to be one of our assumptions. So we are going to assume that AP dagger creates a particle with momentum P at time T. There should be some operator that does that. We're just giving it a name. It There should be some operator at each time t that creates particle with momentum p, and we'll just call those operators our creation operators. So in a sense, we can take this as a definition. And at equal times, we're also going to assume that the creation and annihilation operators have the same commutation relations as in the free theory. So we can think of this as just the definition of some set of operators. So what we're going to, these first two are generally going to be true. The next statement you were asked to see whether you expected it should be true or not in an interacting field theory was whether the form factor is the same as in the free theory. So a number of things went into this calculation, which you did in the free theory in your quiz. So basically, what you had to use was the fact that the momentum eigenstate was the creation operator acting on the vacuum, which we're basically assuming that doesn't change in the interacting theory. So that part's okay. We also needed to assume that the relationship between the field operator and the creation and annihilation operator had a particular form. So that was another ingredient in this calculation. And in general, you'd expect it's perfectly reasonable to expect that to change. That, after all, when we derived this relation, that phi of x is equal to the integral, or Lorentz invariant measure, we found that the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation could be put in this form. And well, the Klein-Gordon equation was our equation of motion because of the form of the Lagrangian we assumed when we were studying the free Klein-Gordon theory. If we add additional terms in our Lagrangian, we'll have, in general, additional terms in our equation of motion. And the form of the solution should, in general, change. Nevertheless, we are going to assume that this relationship holds, even though, unlike in the free theory, we're not going to derive it. And I'll try to justify this in more detail later, but in a sense, we can think of this relationship as defining, we can absorb any differences between the free and the interacting theory into the time dependence of these creation and annihilation operators. So we can, even if the form of the solution in general doesn't have the same time dependence as in the free theory, we can just force all of the extra time dependence to go into the time dependence of the creation and annihilation operators. So we're going to assume this holds. It's reasonable to expect that this changes, but nevertheless, we'll assume it holds. And I'll have more justification for why we're allowed to do this in the second half of the lecture. Okay. And so then the fourth statement on the quiz was whether you expected the creation and annihilation operators to have the same time dependence as in the free theory. So in general, we would That's not going to be the case because, if they did have the same time dependence, then there would be no way for a one particle state to time evolve into a three particle state. It would be necessary if you have an unstable particle that can get into three particles. So in the interacting theory, the creation and annihilation operators evolve in time, and essentially they mix. So you can have, if we're looking at a creation operator at some time, it might be a mixture of creation operators, of different numbers of creation operators at a different time. So we could have a one particle state that evolves into a multi-particle state, or which is a desirable feature. And the last statement was that whether or not you expected the field operator acting in the vacuum to be one particle state all time, that's going to be slightly too strong of a requirement, but we are going to impose some requirements that phi of x acting in the vacuum is at least a one particle state in the asymptotic past and future. Okay, so our assumptions in, I'm going to phrase them in several different ways throughout the lecture, but one way to phrase them is we're assuming that creation operator creates a one particle state at a fixed time. We're assuming that the field operator is related to the creation and annihilation operators in the same way as in the free theory. And we're also going to assume that we have the same relation between, say, the creation operator. We can invert the relationship in the same way, and the creation operator is related to the field operator in the same way as in the free theory. So this has some additional assumptions about what the momentum looks like. When you derive this equation, not only did you need to use the relationship between the field operator and the creation and annihilation operators, you also needed to use the relationship between the momentum operator and the creation and annihilation operators. So this has some additional assumptions about what the relationship between the momentum operator and creation and annihilation operators is also unchanged. So in one form, these are the assumptions we're going to make. Basically, going to make.
Why is that an assumption again? Like, why isn't that just a consequence of the formula? What? Because I'm differentiating
with
respect to time now.
Yes. And there's a traditional time dependence here. So these are assumptions. So another way of phrasing our assumption is that basically the only thing that changes between the free and the interacting theory is the time dependence of the creation and annihilation operators. It's a fairly strong assumption, and we'll assume it for now and check it in this. We'll spend the second half of lecture discussing why we're justified in making these assumptions. But for now, this is basically our key assumption, is that the only change is in the time dependence.
The inner products and the exponentials, is this the four vector inner product or the three vector one?
These are four vectors. So this here is the Heisenberg picture field. Throughout today's lecture, we're going to be working the Heisenberg picture. And just as a reminder, when I write So there's, this is an integral just over the three components of the momentum, and implicit in this formula is that k0 is equal to ea. Okay. And basically, so our goal now is going to be to derive a relationship between this amplitude and these vacuum expectation values of a time-ordered product of fields. And the procedure for relating these two objects is basically the same no matter how many particles we have in the initial state and how many particles we have in the final state. For simplicity, I'm just going to focus on the case, the simplest non-trivial case, which is where we have two particles in the initial state and two particles in the final state. But this generalizes rather readily to the case where we have n particles in the initial state and m particles in the final state. So we'll be considering 2-to-2 scattering. And we'll assume that our initial state is in the asymptotic past. So in the asymptotic past, we'll assume we start with a two-particle state where we've got creation operator in the far past, two creation operators in the far past acting on the vacuum state, which I'm going to note as omega to distinguish it from the pre-particle vacuum, which I indicated by zero. In general, the vacuum of a interacting theory is different from the vacuum of a free theory. If you add terms to the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian, you'll in general change the ground state energy. So this is the interacting vacuum. And
what did you say about the interacting vacuum?
So this is the vacuum of the interacting theory, which is in general different from the vacuum of the free theory, which I denoted by zero.
But it's still just the state of minimum energy of our Hamiltonian.
That's right. So next week we'll go to the interacting picture and we'll be considering both essentially at the same time. It's worth distinguishing them. And because we're going to be writing this a lot, I'm going to introduce some shorthand. So I'm going to define this to be A1 of minus infinity and A2. I'm just going to omit the K just to save a little bit of writing. And similarly, our final state is going to be a two-particle state in the far future. So using the same notation, this will be A3 dagger at plus infinity, A4 dagger at plus infinity, acting on the vacuum state. And so what we want to do is we want to relate the amplitude FSI to a time-ordered product of fields. So in order to do that, we're going to have to relate these creation operators to our field operators using our assumption that we can use this formula. And to do that, there's a useful identity, which derive in a second, which is that A1 at plus infinity minus a1 dagger at minus infinity is equal to minus I times the integral d4x e to the minus I k dot x d squared plus m squared 5x, and I'll abbreviate this right hand side as I dagger 1. Okay. So this is useful because, well, if we compute the amplitude fsi, we've got creation operators on the right and annihilation operators at the left, but they're at different times. And we're only assuming that the commutation relations are the same at equal times. So we need to relate the creation and annihilation operators at different times to each other in order to use the commutation relations to evaluate the amplitude we're interested in. And this this formula will let us do that. It'll let us relate the creation and annihilation operators in the far past and in the far future to each other, so we can use the commutation relations. And fortunately, this identity also involves the field operator, which is what we're interested in relating our amplitude to.
How do, like, quickly, just to sketch, how do you, we get from to that formula?
That's the next thing I was going to do.
Okay.
I just wanted to see why we're doing it first, yes.
There should be a one dependency, right, on the right side somehow. Otherwise, it doesn't depend on the K1.
This should be a K1.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, so that's why this identity is useful. And Yvonne, asking the next thing you do is say why is it true? So let's derive this identity, and we'll see. Actually, once we've derived this identity, we're most of the way there to the LSE reduction formula. We'll just need to use this identity a few times to derive the relationship we're interested in. Okay, so what we're considering is difference in the creation operators, past and future. And the first thing we can do is note that we can write this as an integral over time of the derivative, time derivative of A1 dagger T, just in the fundamental theorem of calculus. And then the next thing to do is we'll use our assumed relationship between the creation operator and the field operator, this one over here. And that will let us write this as a integral, not just over time, but over space-time. And we get a factor of minus I, the derivative, time derivative of e to the minus I k1 dot x, and another time derivative, 5x plus I e k1. 5x. So this is where our assumption comes into play. So we've got here four terms. So this derivative can act on this exponential, or this field operator, or this field operator. And we'll get four terms, but two of them cancel. So if we act with this derivative on the exponential, we'll bring down a factor of minus I e k1 which will cancel off with the term where this derivative acts on this field operator. So the only terms we get are this exponential times the derivative of phi, or where the derivative is acting on the exponential times this term with no derivatives on the fields. So we get here a e to the minus I k1 dot x d squared 5x plus k squared 5x. The other two terms cancel, and we can rewrite this. Ek is k squared plus m squared. So this is d squared by d squared plus k squared plus m squared, all acting on 5x. And we can rewrite k is the same as minus grad squared. See that we could because we could integrate by parts twice to bring the derivative over to the exponential, and we just bring down a k squared. So these derivatives combine to give us just the d mu, the d squared, the four-dimensional d squared. And so what we're left with is the promised result. That's exactly what we wanted. And note that this is not zero in an interacting theory. So the Klein-Gordon equation is that d squared plus m squared acting on phi is zero. That equation of motion follows from the form of the Lagrangian. If we have an interacting theory, we have some extra terms in Lagrangian, so this will no longer be zero. Any questions on that? And we can take the conjugate of this equation to get relationship between the annihilation operators in the future and in the past. So that would just change the signs in front of the eyes. Okay, so, yes.
We're talking a lot about interacting theories. What are you calling an interacting theory in this case?
Basically, any other scalar field theory besides the Klein-Gordon theory. So if we have we could add a cubic term in the Lagrangian. So an example, our Lagrangian could be the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. For example, we could add a phi cube term.
So do we also, we only have one term? We're going to go one field? We're still going to call this an interacting theory?
Yes, so there's self-interactions. Yes. For now, we're just considering a single field. We will generalize it next week to when we have multiple fields. So the amplitude we want to compute is the amplitude for our initial state with two particles in the asymptotic past, do time evolve into some future state with two particles in the asymptotic future. And by assumption, this can be written as omega A4 at plus infinity, A3, plus infinity, A1 dagger, minus infinity, A2 dagger, at minus infinity. And one useful observation for this state is that this state is already time ordered. So all of the operators that are later occur to the left. So I can insert the time ordering symbol. I'll explain what that means in just a second. So the time ordering symbol, if we have a time ordering of two operators, or it works similarly if we have more than two operators. This is defined to be O of x, O of y, if O is the later operator, if x naught is greater than y naught, and O of y, O of x, if y naught is greater than x naught. So time ordering symbol just says put whichever operators are later on the left. And it shows up in many steps, or many of the key results in this this computation that I outlined at the beginning of lecture. So these are already time ordered, so we're not changing anything if we insert this time order symbol. So the next thing we can do is we can use this identity and relate the creation and annihilation operators in the far past to the far future. If we do that, what we get is, well, there's going to be I guess 2 to the 4th terms. We'll get, we replace these. A4 will be replaced with I4 and also A4 at minus infinity, similarly for all of the terms. So we'll get one term that looks like A4 at minus infinity, 3 at minus infinity, A1 dagger plus infinity, A2 dagger at plus infinity, omega. There'll be other terms, but let's just look at this term first. So this term, because of the time ordering symbol, it means we should reorder these operators so that the later operators occur to the left. So A1 and A2 dagger should be placed to the left, where they annihilate the vacuum bra. And similarly, the A3 at minus infinity and A4 at minus infinity should be placed to the right, where they will annihilate the vacuum cat. So this term is zero because the creation operators are at later times. And almost all of the terms we get after we use the useful identity will likewise be zero. So as long as we have any creation or annihilation operators, that will be enough in order for that term to be zero. So if we have, if most of these were I's instead of creation or annihilation operators, it would still be true that the term would be zero, as long as we have at least one creation or annihilation operator left. So there's a whole bunch of other terms. They're all zero. And then there's one term that just involves the I's. And only this term survives. And so this term is just the time-ordered, involves the time-ordered product of field operators. And that's our key result from today's lecture, is that we compute this FSI using this formula. And let me just write it out explicitly, what this term looks like. So FSI is each of the i's has a factor of square root of minus 1. Also have product over the integrals over spacetime, one for each of the i's. We have exponential factors where the sign depends on whether or not it's an I dagger or just an I. So here lambda j will be equal to plus 1 if it's an initial particle, and minus 1 if it's a final particle. We then have a Klein-Gordon operator for each of the particles. Here, my notation d squared j is eta mu nu d x mu j d x mu j nu. Acting on this vacuum expectation value of the time order product fields. And introduce one more shorthand notation here. So phi I is defined to be phi of x I. And this is the LSD reduction formula. This is the key result for today's lecture.
This is being integrated over, right?
Yes. In this last step, I've done basically only one small thing. I've switched the time ordering symbol and the derivatives, which is slightly questionable, but the final result is correct. It can be justified more carefully. I'm not going to do that here. But it works out in the end.
What would you repeat the time ordering, like, what does it do?
Time ordering places the operators that follow it in the order from the latest operator to the earliest operator. From the operator, so remember we're working in the Heisenberg picture, so all these operators are time dependent. So if the order of these operators is that x04 is the greatest, and x02 is the second greatest, and x03 is the third greatest, and x01 is the greatest, and we put them in the order without using any commutation relations. Just this time ordering means whatever operators follow should be placed by hand in the order with the latest operators to the left, the earliest operators to the right. Similar to normal ordering, it's a definition for or a prescription for what order the operators that follow time ordering symbol should be evaluated. Any other?
What was the logic in last step when you expanded in this time order? Like, I get that. Because it seems to me that we want to get to the final thing, and the rest of the terms are just corrections because the final thing is not the same as the first thing, and those corrections just are null.
All these other terms are zero. For example, this first term. So this.
No, I get what that term is zero, but like, how was it that we did that expansion? What was what?
Oh, to go from this line to this line.
Yes.
To go from this line to this line, we used four times this relation. So for A1, we use this relation. For A2, we use a similar thing. For A3, had a dagger, we use this version.
Yes. I was wondering, I missed at the beginning, when we did our FSI and then we expanded it, where did the S go, the S matrix? Is that the...
Oh.
So like we just put the F and the I, right?
Yes. So. Oh, okay. So. I should have put over here. Should have been an S here. Or. Yeah. So. Our initial and final states are at different times, so we need to evolve from either the past to the future or the future to the past. Any other questions? Yes.
Did we ever show that this, like, this FSI is equal to the time order part?
So this was our, we assumed that SI was A1 dagger, A2 dagger at hand zero. And that, so this first one is basically by assumption. And the next line is we just noted that, these operators are already in time order. We have all of the latest operators to the left and all of the earlier operators are to the right. So we haven't changed anything by inserting this.
We could do the same derivation without using this time order and then get the result without the T.
We could. This turns out to be a useful formula. It's actually desirable to have the time ordering in this vacuum expectation value. It will make next week's calculations easier. We could do a similar thing without time ordering. It'd be less useful. Also, the time ordering helps us in this step. Right? It makes all these extra terms zero. So that's related. Other comments or questions?
This is one other thing. So now we're looking at 2 to 2 scattering. So that's what I assume 2 plus 2s are for.
That's right. So if we were looking at n to m scattering, we'd replace these twos with n's and m's. Otherwise, yeah, this formula works for scattering of an arbitrary number of particles. We've derived the LSE reduction formula, which gives us the promised relationship between amplitude, we're interested in computing, and this simpler object, which is the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product fields. And to derive it, we had to make a number of assumptions, some of which were perhaps a little bit questionable. So in the second half of the lecture, we're going to discuss and justify in some more detail the assumptions we made. And first, we're going to rephrase these in a slightly different way, but they're on this. Yes.
So in that step,
move the board.
Yes. In that step, where you wrote down all the possible terms, if it was not already time ordered, then not all the terms would be zero.
Right? That's right. We'd have more terms. Okay. So. Another way to phrase our assumptions is we assumed that phi of x acting on the vacuum evaluated at t equals plus or minus infinity is a one particle state. And we also assumed that omega 5x k is e to the minus I kx for all time. Okay, so why are these statements equivalent to what we assumed over here? So we assumed that A creates a one-particle state. A dagger creates a one-particle state for all time. We also assume that our creation annihilation operators have the same equal time commutation relations. And we assume that the field is related to the creation and annihilation operators the same way as in the free theory. Form factor assumption is basically equivalent to this assumption here. Because remember, when you computed the form factor, what you had to do was basically use the fact that AK dagger was a one particle, acting in the vacuum is the one particle state. Then use the commutation relations, and basically what you got out was that the form factor is basically this coefficient of either the annihilation or creation operator, depending on if you're looking at, I think I wrote the form factor conjugate or conjugated in two different ways. But this is essentially, the result of our calculation is essentially just this coefficient. And so this relationship, assuming that this relationship and these commutation relations are the same, is equivalent to assuming that the form factor is unchanged. We also assumed that that's at least if we assume that the field operator is linear in the creation and annihilation operators. And so assuming if the field operator is linear in the creation annihilation operators is equivalent to assuming that phi is a one particle state. And so that's this assumption. So basically the fact that we assume that phi is linear in the creation and annihilation operators and the creation and annihilation operators has these particular coefficients is why these two assumptions are the same.
Is with the minus sign or?
I wrote the, it's in the opposite order. So if I wrote k by, okay, I can, just to be consistent with what I did before, I'll switch. Okay. So these are our assumptions in a different way of phrasing it and a more convenient way of phrasing it to examine them. So what do we need to check in order to check these states? We assume this. Sorry, we assume this for all time. We assume this. So what do we need to check? So if this is a one particle state, then, well, what do we mean by one particle state? So one particle state should be in some way distinguishable from states with a different number of particles. So in particular, a one particle state should be different from the zero particle state. So vacuum is a zero particle state. So if phi of x is a one particle state, then the overlap of phi of x acting on the vacuum with the vacuum state should be zero. This is saying that a one particle state should be different from a zero particle state. We also need to check that the form factor is in fact what I claimed it is. And, well, the last thing is that a one particle state should be not only different from a zero particle state, it should be different from a state with two or more particles. Okay, and so what we're going to find is that, well, in a general interacting theory, these statements are not always true in general, but we can make them true. In other words, if we slightly manipulate our theory, we can impose these things so that we can, are allowed to use the LSE formula. And we'll see what kind of modifications we're going to have to make to our theory, but they're going to be small but important modifications. Okay, so the first thing we want to check is whether or not our one particle states are different from our zero particle states. So we want this to be zero. And what can we say about this in a general interacting theory? There's not a lot we can say about this. One thing we know is that we can write phi of x as I e dot x I have 0 e to the minus I p at x, where p mu is the four momentum operator, so h and the three momentum operator. You can think of this relationship as just like a generalization of going from the Schrodinger to the Heisenberg picture, or instead of just doing a time translation, we're also doing a space translation of our operator. And using this relation, we can write omega 5x omega as omega e to the I e dot x 5 0 e to the minus I e hat dot x omega. So these are translation operators, and instead of acting with them on the field operator, we can act with them on the vacuum state. And we expect our vacuum state to be translation invariant. So as long as the vacuum is translation invariant, then if we translate the vacuum, we should get back the vacuum state. And so we can write this as omega 5 0 omega. And that's really as much as we can do based on general considerations. So there's no reason a priori that this has to be 0. But what we do see is that this is a Lorentz invariant number. This is just a Lorentz scalar. Lorentz transformation. This vacuum expectation value doesn't change. So here we just use translation invariance. Vacuum. And so this is, in general, just some Lorentz invariant number. Which we can call V. Well, this is bad if this is non-zero. Yes.
So is this translational invariance because it's a vacuum state?
The vacuum state, yes. So if we're dealing with a Lorentz invariant theory, we expect that most likely the vacuum state is also translation invariant. This is an additional assumption. We didn't derive it, but it's true in most cases.
But only for the vacuum state?
Only for the vacuum state, yes. Our states with particles, of course, will not be translation invariant. Okay.
Is there a deeper reason to assume that the vacuum is translation?
It seems to be the case observationally. We don't observe any violations of Lorentz invariance in our universe. So either in all the interactions we know of are Lorentz invariant, but there doesn't seem to be any observational evidence. So this is this would be a problem if the one particle states don't have a zero overlap with the zero particle states, then there's not really a meaningful sense in which they're different, and our whole derivation essentially falls apart. But there's an easy fix. Which has important consequences, but there's an easy way to fix this. And the easy way to fix this is we can just redefine our field. So we'll redefine phi tilde to be of x to be phi of x minus v. So even if the original field we're interested in has a non-zero vacuum expectation value, we can just redefine our field. So, and our new field, which is just a shifted version of the old field, will have zero vacuum excitation on it. So with the shifted field, there will be a difference between the one particle state phi tilde of x acting on the vacuum and the vacuum. So those states will have zero overlap. They're meaningfully different. And so while we couldn't use the LSE formula in the way I derived it for the original field, for the shifted field, at least so far, we're OK. So for the shifted field, we're OK. And I'll drop the tildes for now. But basically, for the remainder of the course, we're going to assume that we shift our fields in this way, so that this one particle state is different from this zero particle state.
That's basically what it means to shift the field.
Well, so what we observe is are the particles in a state. So really, we're shifting the field is we're trying to come up with a relationship between our fields and the particles that we observe, and in terms of this original field, that's a really messy thing to do. In terms of the new field, there's a clear relationship between the field and the particles, which the physics will be the same in terms of both fields, but the interpretation would just be horrible in terms of these other fields.
What actual expansion in terms of creation and annihilation operators when you do this shift?
So if we do this shift, we're just essentially adding a constant term. So once the creation and annihilation operators are operators, we're just shifting the field by some real or, in general, complex value constant. So that's wouldn't affect the operators themselves. So we'd have.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be able to expand like both operators, both fields, like phi and phi tilde, in terms of creation and.
In this form, yes, no. So phi tilde will have an expansion like this. Phi, if we don't shift in general, we'll have an extra term which we don't want.
Sorry, could you explain a bit more about why that term is Lorentz invariant? Because it.
This is one particle state. So this is a amplitude. So it's an amplitude for this one particle state to evolve into the vacuum. So the state itself, if we translate it without this omega here, we'd still have an operator e to the x, so that would transform. But we're looking at this amplitude, that's the Lorentz invariant. So for any x, this vacuum expectation value is the same. It's always equal to vacuum expectation value of this operator evaluated at zero.
So the 5, 0 is Lorentz invariant?
Yes. 5, 0 by itself is not Lorentz invariant, but this expectation value is. We can, for any x, we can relate it to the same thing. So the next assumption we want to check is whether the form factor is Correct. So again, there's not a lot we can say based on general principles for what K by omega should be. Basically, the only thing we can use is the Lorentz and translation properties of the field operator. So again, we can write this as e to the I p hat dot x by 0 minus I p hat dot x omega. So k is a momentum eigenstate. So if we act with this operator on the state k, we just get e to the I k dot x. And over here we get k y of 0 omega. And so let's proceed further. We can do a boost. So there's some unitary operator that boosts from k to 0. Here u is a and Gong will tell you more about this operator. The only property this operator will really need in my part of the course is that it exists. There should be some operator that implements boosts. And so if this is the operator that boosts from k to 0, then this is the state, momentum eigenstate with 0 momentum. Phi is a scalar, so it's invariant under boosts. And I'll assume the vacuum state is also invariant under boosts. So this is phi of 0, and this is omega. So we can write this as e to the I k dot x, p equals 0, phi of 0, omega. And so this should be, this is some Lorentz invariant number. The only thing this can possibly depend on is the mass squared. There's no other, there's nothing else in this state, or in this amplitude, that we can use to construct a Lorentz invariant. But in general, there's no reason to expect this to be equal to 1 either. So not necessarily equal to 1, which is what we want. So this is, again, a problem if this amplitude is not 1. We essentially assumed it was 1 before, when we assumed that this relationship between the field operator and the creation annihilation operator had the same form as in the free theory. If it was different from 1, the coefficients of the creation and annihilation operators would be different. So this is not 1. Our derivation of the LSE formula falls apart. But fortunately, like before, there's an easy fix. So if we simply rescale our field operators and define some new field operators phi tilde, which are just some number, some real or complex number times our old field operators, we can eliminate this term. And that will be justified in assuming that our field operators are related to our creation and annihilation operators in the same way.
Sorry, I just missed why u 5 0 u minus 1 is again.
So u is a unitary operator that implements a boost. And so if we boost a scalar field, it doesn't transform. The scalar fields are invariant under boosts.
So what we just verified are like necessary conditions which follow from the particular form of phi of x and a dagger of x that we wrote above. But like, is it sufficient, the verification of these two conditions? Is it sufficient to imply that phi of x and a dagger of t have that form?
Okay, so what we've essentially verified is that we're okay not including a constant term in phi. We're okay assuming that the coefficient of the creation and annihilation operators are what they seem to be, this exponential factor. The one thing we haven't checked is, well, you could imagine in principle there could be some nonlinear terms in the creation and annihilation operators in that formula. And so if there were nonlinear terms there, then there would be a non-zero overlap between phi of x acting in the vacuum and a multi-particle state. So the last thing we need to check in order to justify our assumption is that there's no overlap between our one particle state, phi of x acting in the vacuum, and the multi-particle states. So the last thing we need to check is that multi-particle states are different from one particle states. Or the particular one particle state we're interested in. So I'm going to write a general one multi-particle state like this. So here, P is going to be the total three momentum of the state. And sigma will be all other parameters needed to describe the state. So that could be things like the number of particles, which is this discrete number, at least if we're looking at particle number eigenstates. And it also includes continuous parameters like relative momenta. I just want to single out the total three momenta from the various parameters we need to specify our multiparticle state. So we can try the same thing we did before. So if we compute the overlap of P sigma with phi omega, what we get is that, well, again, there's not too much we can say in general. We can try the same thing as before by writing phi of x in terms of translation operators. And we get, again, This, we get a factor of e to the I p dot x because this is a momentum eigenstate by assumption. P sigma 50 omega. And again, there's no reason to expect this factor to be zero in general. So this is potentially more problematic. We had an easy fix before. We could just shift and rescale. There's a lot of different states here, though. So in order to make all of these amplitudes zero, we'd have generally we don't have enough freedom to do that. So this is potentially a more serious problem than the first two. The first two we fixed just by shifting and rescaling. But it turns out this is slightly stronger condition than we need. We'll actually be okay if this amplitude is non-zero for finite time. What we really want is just to be able to distinguish. It's sufficient if we can just distinguish asymptotic multiparticle states from asymptotic particle states. In fact, if this was zero for all time, then there'd be no way for a one particle state to decay into a multiparticle state, which is something we observe and something we like to be able to describe in quantum field theory. So we still want to have some notion of the number of particles in state, but that's it's good enough if we can do that asymptotically. And so what you can show, and it's in the notes, I won't go through it in lecture, it's slightly more technical than we've done before, but what you can show is that if you construct a multiparticle wave packet and construct a one particle wave packet, something that not just completely low, not something that's just 5x, but some wave packet that's localized near x, you can show that it's automatic based on the assumptions we've already made that the one particle wave packet and the multiparticle wave packets have zero overlap as t goes to plus or minus infinity. And so that turns out to be enough to forbid extra terms in the relationship. So this one, this relationship, this in terms of that we can automatically distinguish one particle and multiparticle states in asymptotic times. We don't have to do anything to our field. What we have to do is we have to shift and rescale our field if we want to make our first two assumptions work, that the vacuum excitation of all the field is zero and that the form factor is correct. So if we want to use perturbation theory to study AE theory with interactions, so for example, one theory we're going to study next week is this theory that has cubic self-interactions. And a key ingredient in our study of interacting field theories is the LSE formula. So in order to use the LSE formula, in order to compute observables in this theory, which has self-interactions, in general, what we have to do is we have to shift and rescale. Because we assumed that the vacuum expectation value was zero and that the form factor was e to the ikx in our derivation of the LSE formula. So in order to use that to study this theory, we have to shift and rescale. So it's, in general, not valid to use the LSE formula to study this theory where we just added an extra interaction term. If we want to study this theory, in general, we have to shift and rescale. If we shift and rescale, the Lagrangian will change. So if we rescale, the coefficient in front of the kinetic term will in general be different. The coefficient in front of the mass term will in general be different. The coefficient in front of our interaction term will in general be different. And furthermore, if we shift this field, we'll generate not just a cubic term, but a linear term as well. So in general, we'll add a new term. So another way of saying this is that in order to use the LSE formula to do perturbation theory, to study interacting field theories, we have to renormalize our theory. We're not allowed to choose the normalization for our fields in any way we like. There's a particular way we have to shift and rescale by a particular amount in order for the LSE formula to be valid. And so the conditions that we imposed, that omega phi of x is zero, and that k phi of x is e to the I k dot x, imposes constraints on what these coefficients have to be. So we're forced to renormalize our theory. We want to use the LSE formula, which is a key ingredient in doing perturbation theory. So this is something we have to do. It turns out, at leading order in perturbation theory, the ZIs are all 1, and Y is 0. So In other words, we don't have to shift and rescale if we're only interested in doing leading order perturbation theory. But beyond leading order, this is something we have to do. So for now, when we first study perturbation theory next week, we're going to work at leading order, in which case it's okay to ignore this problem. But this is it's something we have to do. We have to renormalize our theory in order to use the LSE formula. And we'll come back to that at the end of next week and see what kind of constraints we get.
I don't understand why when we shift we get a linear term.
So if we have phi minus some constant v cubed, this will give us a cubic term in phi, a cubic term in phi, a quadratic term in phi, a linear term in phi, as well as a constant term, which is uninteresting.
So the fact that in Cornelism, you cannot distinguish between one particle state and multi-particle state at a finite time, does that hint anything about the observation, like you're observing at like very small time, so you cannot really get that. You cannot distinguish between the states because there's a non-zero overlap.
That's right. Well,
does that tell something about?
In some sense, this was expected because we expect transitions between states with different numbers of particles. And so if those transitions can occur, they have to occur at some time. So at the best we could really hope for was that we could asymptotically distinguish between one and multiple.
Yeah, but like just zeroing into this like particular issue. So is it because of this that we have to like actually renormalize your like theory because we cannot distinguish between multi-particle and one-particle states?
This is automatic. We didn't have to change our theory at all in order for to be able to distinguish the one and multi-particle states. What we had to do in order to justify the assumptions we made in deriving the LSE formula was we had to shift the field in order for the vacuum excitation value to be zero. It's one of the assumptions we made when we derived the LSE formula. We had to rescale it, get the form factor correct. So these two things were made us modify our theory. The multi-particle considerations, although it's important conceptually, it didn't force us to make any changes to our theory. We don't have to do anything extra in order to be able to distinguish between one and multi-particle states. Are there any other comments or questions? All right, have a great Thanksgiving, and I'll see you on Tuesday.